Our main speaker today is Dr. Robert Carter from Creation Ministries International. We had this organization here with us about a year and a half ago. They're here just for Sunday and Sunday night service. And Jerry and I talked afterwards, and we said, you know, we'd really like to have these guys back for a full event. And so they've been with us Friday morning. They were with the school, talking with the students from second grade all the way to high school. We had a lot of great Q&A with them. Friday night they were here, and Saturday morning as well. And Rob has been speaking both services this morning, and his colleague, Keaton Halley, has been down with the teens at 9:30. So I'm going to stop talking and ask Rob to come up. He's done a great job. I heard from numerous people on Friday and Saturday that they wish he could have talked for 2 or 3 hours. Now, he doesn't really have quite a time limit because this is the last service, but he does know that you guys want to get home in time to see the football game. So we'll leave it to Rob, and thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning, everybody. You now know who I am. I'm Robert Carter. I happen to be a scientist, but the most important part of my life is that I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. I'm here this morning, hopefully to encourage some of you that we have answers to some of those questions that might be troubling you. I am a marine biologist by training. I spent years scuba diving in the Bahamas and Belize and Florida Keys. I mean, it was a very difficult life. But I ended up in the genetics lab, and I was studying corals. I was studying these colors in these corals. I figured out that these colors are caused by proteins that happen to fluoresce when you shine ultraviolet light on them. And I said, oh, well, if they're proteins, I can steal the gene. And so I did. I stole the genes from these, and when I engineered these genes into these fish, I made the Frankenfish, and I was granted a PhD. But I just opened up a giant can of worms, didn't I? Is this moral? Are we allowed to do this? Where's the line that we can draw? You know, there are moral questions around every corner in science for the Christian today, and some of the stuff is difficult. But I tell you what, I found a guide for my science on the first page of the Bible. Genesis chapter 1, verse 28. And God blessed them, this is Adam and Eve, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. To have dominion means to take care of. They're stewards of creation. And as their descendants, we would have inherited that responsibility. But to take care of something means you have to understand that something. The pursuit of understanding is called science. The role of science in God's economy is for us to fulfill our role in God's created order. And as we learn more about science, we learn more about what God did, and we bring glory to God the Creator. Science and creation are very intricately linked together. We've been writing about how science and the Bible fit together for over 40 years in our Creation magazine. And just as an aside, you're going to see little pictures of Creation magazine popping up throughout my talk. That's just to show you how much information I got for this talk out of Creation magazine. I've been reading this, I think, since about 1989, 1990. I don't remember when it was. I went to hear a Creation speaker at Wyuka Road Baptist Church in Atlanta. And I didn't believe it. I wasn't there. And yet I subscribed to Creation Magazine, and I think this is the tool that God used to put me in Christianity. Squarely in Christianity. I was dabbling with it before that. We also have a gigantic website, creation.com. I hope you go there when I'm done. Ask a question. Put it in a little search box and see what pops up. We have, I think, 13,000 articles on our website. We've answered the question. And if we didn't or we didn't do a good job, send us an email and we'll answer the email. Sometimes those emails become new articles. We're here to answer your question. We call ourselves an information ministry. Our job is to go to churches, and we're going to visit about 1,300 churches around the world this year. We have a team of about 30 speakers doing just this, going to where you are to answer your questions. Because what we find is that people who have their basic questions answered are much more likely to talk about Jesus than people who are terrified, if that person asked me that question, I wouldn't know what to say. I know it's true in my own life. You'll also see that a lot of our articles deal with a cultural battle happening in the Western world right now. And so some of our articles have sort of a a struggle warfare theme. Well, let me start off with an illustration of this battle. How many of you have heard of Billy Graham? Great. How many of you have heard of his good friend, Charles Templeton? That's it? Are you kidding me? Billy Graham was the other guy. Charles Templeton was the man. Charles Templeton was a guy filling stadiums full of people back in the early 50s. But he drifted away, and before he died, he wrote this book called Farewell to God, My Reasons for Rejecting the Christian Faith. The man died an atheist. And in that book, he documents his specific reasons for rejecting Christianity. And amongst them, he claims, oh, the Bible has no answer to the age of the earth question. Has it ever troubled you how old the earth is? How about the existence of ape men? Or how did Noah build that giant boat? Or where did the floodwaters go after the flood was over? Those are the questions Templeton claimed could not be answered, therefore the Bible was not true. You know what's humbling? It was when I was a young man, I had those same questions. And most of my friends I grew up with who had those questions are not walking with God today. I should have gone down that route, but God met me along the way. And I found answers to those questions that were derailing my faith. This is one particular example. This was, for me, the proof of evolution. Pachycetus, the whale from Pakistan. And I remember seeing these pictures. Look at that. It's perfectly intermediate between land animals and aquatic animals. This is where whales came from. This is the proof I needed for me to say evolution is a fact. I didn't know it at the time, but this fanciful picture was based on a couple of bones found in a skull. That's the blue bones is all they found. The rest of the body was just interpretation. Good interpretation or bad interpretation? Well, the world was waiting for the rest of the skeleton to be discovered. And when they discovered the rest of it, I realized, and the science realized, there's nothing transitional about this fossil. It is, in fact, a land animal, fully adapted to life on land. And I said to myself, I think I've been lied to. What else have I been lied to about? And that caused me to go on a lifelong quest to find out the truth behind this creation evolution debate. You know, we have more information on this topic than any other time in church history. We should be shouting, the Bible's history! And yet most people in America have never heard a Christian defend the Bible. I was 19 years old. I'd gone to church all of my life. I never met anyone who thought the Bible was true, or at least said the Bible was true. In fact, I was over at this girl's house that I met in college, and you know, I kind of had a crush on her, so I went over her house, and her mom started talking to me. And her mom started indicating she didn't believe in evolution. And her mom started like giving me stuff that I'd never heard before. I thought this woman was crazy. And yet now I agree with her. She wasn't some PhD scientist. She's just a regular old lady who didn't want her daughter to date a problematic person. And so she was poking me with questions to see where I was. And I was a jerk. I insulted her. No, I never did date her daughter. Anyway, beside the point, she and I are good friends still today, her mom and the daughter. I was a young punk who thought I knew everything. And this lady who did not have a science degree asked me a couple of things and challenged me. In fact, she's the one that pointed out that Pachycetus had been discovered, and I didn't know it yet. We've got tons of information. You can answer their questions. But first, we have to learn what the questions are. And yet, when we look at the statistics, there's four different surveys, four different groups of people, different questions. They're trying to get at the question, how many people growing up in church are going to leave and not come back? Now, if you think this is some liberal denominations, that 88% comes from the Southern Baptist Sunday School Board. Is this somebody else's kids or our kids? Do all of you have examples? Someone who raised up in the church and went away afterwards and won't come back? I'm sure almost every single one of you knows somebody. Well, we took a TV camera and a crew, and we went to college campuses all within like a two-hour drive of Atlanta, a whole bunch of different college campuses. And we interviewed students, and we asked them very simple questions. We said, were you raised in church? If they said no, we said, okay, see ya. If they said yes, we said, oh, when you were growing up, were you ever taught anything about creation and evolution? If they said no, we say, do you still go to church? Every single student, with one exception, said, no, man, I don't go to church anymore. But if they said, yes, I was taught about creation and evolution, we say, did you still go to church? Every single one of the students that we interviewed say, yes, I still faithfully attend church. Granted, if we had interviewed 10,000 people, we would have found a few on both sides. But all the ones that we interviewed happened to still be going to church. What's happening here? Apparently, or clearly, families that discuss this around the dinner table, churches that teach us in Sunday school or preach it from the pulpit, are raising students who are stronger in their faith. And that is clear from the results of our little documentary. Here's a quote, FoxNews.com last week. This is J. Warner Wallace. He's at the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. Very fascinating. He says, ex-Christians often leave the church because they don't think anyone in the church can answer their questions or make a case. It's time for believers, that's us, to accept the responsibility to explain what Christianity proposes and why these propositions are true, especially when interacting with young people who have legitimate questions. Rather than embracing a blind or unreasonable faith, Christians must develop an informed, forensic faith that can stand up in the marketplace of ideas. We know why young Christians are leaving. Now it's time to give them a reason to stay. Excellent quote. I love it. So we want to talk to people, right? Well, guess what? We have to answer their questions. We have to give them an alternative answer to the thing they think is disproving Christianity. Now, granted, this is going to take science. This is going to be a bit of a struggle for some of us. But you know what? I believe that the things we have to say are not that complicated. And I'm going to try to share with you some easy things that you can use in your conversations. If you would like some help, we have a weekly email newsletter. We call it InfoBytes. Every week, we identify something in the world of science people are talking about or some new discovery, and we write an article, put it on our website, and then attach that in an email, and we send it around to all our people. It's a great way to stay up to date on what the culture's talking about right now, and it'll give you a lot of firepower in your discussions because it's a big thing that someone's likely to bring up. You will have a reasonable answer for, we believe. If you'd like to get our email newsletter, we're going to sign around a sign-up form. It looks just like this. We ask for a name, an email address, and a zip code. And why zip code? Because when we send someone out on the road, we email everyone within a certain radius and say, hey, come on, and bring a friend. And everywhere I go, I'm running into people that the reason that they're there is because they got our email. So it's there for you. You get to share it with people. Those are going to go around now. Guys, you can do that. Thank you. And I'm going to keep on talking. But we're talking about science. We have to define what science is. I'm going to give you two different definitions of science. The first is a type of science you learned in eighth grade. By the way, when they get to the end, would you people on the end just walk them across to the other aisle? I'd appreciate that. Okay, that's all I have to say. The type of science you learned in eighth grade is called operational science. You learned how to observe and repeat experiments and test things today. This type of science has given rise to all of our modern technology, including this nuclear-powered rover that NASA drives around Mars, and has nothing to do with evolution. And this type of science is pioneered by Christians, men like Johann Kepler, who discovered the three laws of planetary motion that NASA used to get that rover to Mars. And he said of his work, it was like thinking God's thoughts after him. But it wasn't just Kepler. If you rattled off a list of early modern scientists, you would be listing a group of people, almost all of whom, almost without exception, believe the Bible. Christians laid down the framework for modern science. Have you ever struggled in science class? You know those horrible formulas? Ugh. All those letters? Most of those letters in those formulas are the initials of a Christian's name. Why? Because Christian philosophy and theology gave rise to modern science. It didn't work in Eastern religions because they think the universe is a mirage. It doesn't work in pagan religions because the gods can always come down and mess up your petri dish. It worked in Christianity because the thought that God is unchanging and God never does anything against his own nature, therefore, the God, the creator, would have created the universe that operates according to law. That thought is what gave rise to modern science. How come we don't learn that in our history and science classes? Very interesting question. But I understand that most scientists are not Christians. I got that very well. Why? Well, one reason is that there's different types of science. Besides operational science, there's also historical science. But historical science is when we reach back into the past to try to figure something out that happened. But there's a couple of problems here. One, history is not observable. We don't have a time machine. Two, it's not repeatable. History happens once. And it's not testable. You can't go back in time 100 times and kill Hitler 50 times and not kill Hitler 50 times and do a controlled experiment on history. It doesn't work that way. Historical science is different. And yet, this is where the creation evolution debate is. We're not arguing over the boiling point of water. We're arguing over whether or not Neanderthals are a dead-end branch of humanity. That's a different sort of question. So, let me give you a test. This is science class, okay? Everyone get out your pencils and paper. The question is, true or false? Dead dinosaur sinks to the bottom of the oceans. He's lying there and he rots, and over millions of years, he's slowly buried and petrified. And millions of years later, the rocks are lifted up and erosion exposes a dead dinosaur. True or false? How do you know? What kind of science is this? Is this operational science or historical science? It's historical science. It's an idea of something that happened in the past. But we can test this. Let's get in a submarine. Let's look around the ocean bottoms and find a really big dead thing. What do you think we're going to see? You think we're going to see this? No, because things in the ocean get eaten. In fact, according to the laws of chemistry, bones dissolve in seawater. So science really has to explain this, the fish that looks like he was petrified before he rotted, or this. Do you see the baby ichthyosaur? Was Mama Ichthyosaur lying in the bottom of some warm Mesozoic sea for millions of years as she's slowly buried in a fine sediment and slowly petrified with a baby half born? And the bones aren't eaten or rotted? There's not really any evidence of decay here. Now, her tail is broken, maybe indicating a catastrophic burial. Very curious. I don't think long ages explains this fossil very well at all. This is one of my favorite fossils. It's a salamander. These are gills. That's a tail. The tail's only a few cells thick. How do you turn that to stone? What a great question. Obviously, it happened quickly, or it wouldn't have happened at all. Here's a historical model for you. This is Goldie. He's happily swimming along, and he gets overwhelmed by an underwater avalanche during Noah's flood. And now he's dead. But he's buried in mud. And as the mud dries out, any salts or minerals in that water are going to crystallize. And if we soak that into his bone, we might replace his bones with a crystally stuff. We would call that a fossil. But it has to occur quickly or you're not going to get it. We have a documentary on our tables, Evolution's Achilles Heels. I'm very proud of this. This was 3 years of my life that went into this. We've now won 2 major awards at Christian film festivals for a documentary. At the San Antonio Christian Film Festival, all these Christian movies, but there were 13 documentaries submitted, we were second place. We lost to Mike Huckabee. close. Anyway, I'm very proud of that showing because he had a huge budget and we didn't, and we did very well. Well, what we did is we went around and we only interviewed PhD scientists. Happened to be Bible believers, PhD scientists only. And we say, okay, Mr. Nerdy Science Guy, what can evolution not answer in your area of expertise? And man, they said the most incredibly cool things. We captured Dr. Marcus Ross. He's a professor at Liberty University. He's a paleontologist, a fossil expert. And he said, the existence of a fossil by itself is actually proof that something happened very, very fast. But then he says, but if the fossil happened quickly, the rock that contains the fossil must also have occurred quickly. And now we're talking about the entire fossil record being a record of fast, not slow. That's a profound statement. This man is standing next to a fossilized tree. It's called a polystrate, a many-layered fossil. It's a fossil that sticks vertically through the evolutionary column and defies evolutionary time because trees don't stick up out of the forest for tens of thousands of years as they're slowly buried. They rot, they burn, they get eaten by termites, they fall over. In fact, we have polystrate fossils from different layers all around the world. Each one of them is saying no to the time. Look what I'm doing. I'm trying to get you to question time. How much time has there been is a key question in this debate. But where does the millions of years idea come from? Why do people think that? Well, follow me here. The Grand Canyon is very big. Erosion in the desert is very slow. Therefore, it took millions of years to carve Grand Canyon. True or false? How do you know? What did I just do? I just mixed operational and historical science. I can make observations of the canyon, but historical science, you have to say, I believe that nothing in the past has ever happened to speed up the rate of erosion, but you can't know that's true. We'll get back to this in a second. First, I want to talk about the power of flowing water. A year and a half ago, snow melt in California. There was so much water coming down from the mountains, the highest dam in the United States nearly failed. It would have been catastrophic. They had to release the floodgates and just drain the water from that lake. And what we saw is that compared to the size of the world, a little bit of water flowing down a fairly small hill for only a couple of days not only ate into the steel-reinforced concrete, but carved a canyon 1,200 feet long, 300 feet wide, and 150 feet deep. How did that happen? See, water can flow down a stream for thousands of years and not hardly cause any erosion at all. But once water reaches a certain critical speed, something changes. It's a process called cavitation. Water can flow over surface just fine. But once it gets a little bit too fast, it will lift up from the surface, creating a vacuum, and then the collapsing vacuum pulverizes rock like it's made of dust. The mountain side, which was solid rock, is now a pile of gravel out in the riverbed. That's neat. By the way, you've all seen boat propellers that are pitted on the back edge. That's not from salt water. That's from cavitation. The spinning propeller gets above the speed of cavitation, and those little collapsing bubbles will eat away stainless steel. You've seen it. Water is profoundly powerful under some conditions. This gives me an opportunity to talk about more catastrophe. That's me. Red hair, socks pulled all the way up to the knees. I love those socks. This is fifth grade. I'm living in a beach town in New York. My parents owned a marina. From my second floor window, I could see out over the bay, across the barrier island, and I could see the sun rising. At the end of my fifth grade year, my little scientific mind was like, what on earth is happening? Because the sun kept coming up in this brilliant red ball of fire. Well, it turns out that a volcano 3,000 miles away from my house exploded that year. And Mount St. Helens has given us a tremendous testimony that a lot of geology can happen in a very short time under the right conditions. These layers were laid down by that volcano in 1980 and 1982. There's a woman there for scale. The first big eruption, this is miles away from the volcano. Boom, splat, layer. A month later, a boiling hot cloud of volcanic ash and steam came racing down the mountain at the speed of a hurricane and deposited the middle layer. 2 years later, a mud flow came racing down the mountain out onto the plain, deposited the upper layer, and carved the canyon. And if we zoom up on these layers, here's a middle layer, we see all these little laminations that any geologist before this would have said, count up the layers, count up the years, slow and gradual, millions of years. Hey, Mr. Geologist, I know that these rocks over in Greenland or Iceland or Tajikistan or wherever we are, there's rocks somewhere else in the world that look just like this, and you're telling me these rocks are evidence of millions of years. But these rocks are evidence of minutes. We saw this happen. We didn't see that happen. Mount St. Helens was a tremendous blessing because we saw geology in fast forward. But if we're talking about geology, how fast could it have happened? How much time do we have in Earth's history? Well, if you look at the Bible and you open up to the first page, you're going to be given a very matter-of-fact account of God creating the entire universe in six consecutive days, a little more than 6,000 years ago. Hey, Christian, does that embarrass you? I'm asking you seriously. I was terrified of this. I tried every way you can think of to add millions of years to this. I tried to stretch out the days of Genesis into long periods of time. That worked until someone pointed out, Rob, God can't create the sun millions of years after plants. Well, maybe there's a giant gap right here. But studying the Hebrew, there's no gap. Well, maybe this is just a poetic expression of evolutionary time. Oh, no, because this says would indicate that whales came before land animals, and evolution says that whales came after land animals. Every time I tried, I ran into a brick wall. If you were struggling with this, I want to encourage you to keep struggling. Don't be satisfied with a lame answer. Keep pushing. Keep wrestling. Keep thinking. I believe that that brick wall that you run into cannot be breached. But some of us, like me, are so hard-headed that we have to bash our head against it for a while before we realize it's not going to move. Keep studying. But one of the things that helped me tremendously was looking at how, the way the New Testament treats this. There are over 100 references to Genesis in the New Testament. More than 60 of those come from the first 11 chapters. What's in the first 11 chapters of the Bible? Well, that's Adam and Eve, Noah's flood, and the Tower of Babel. Every single New Testament author references them, including Jesus, at least 16 times, including his famous discourse on marriage and divorce, where he says in Mark chapter 10, "But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." Hey, you know what? Adam and Eve could not have existed at the Big Bang. Clearly, Jesus is referring to the historical account in Genesis. In the parallel passage, I think it's in Luke, he's talking to Pharisees, and he starts off with, "Have you not read?" In other words, I read the Bible, you read the Bible, how come you don't believe the Bible? And then he says this. That's a challenge to us today. It's as if Jesus thought Genesis was true. What do we then do with that? Well, let's look in other places of the Bible. This is Jesus talking to Nicodemus, a Pharisee. Nicodemus is struggling. He says, "Can a man be born again?" And Jesus says, "If I've told you earthly things and you do not believe, how can you believe if I tell you heavenly things?" Well, I believe one of the main reasons why Christianity is struggling to remain relevant in Western cultures today is because people have rejected the earthly things in the Bible. That's the science and the history. And if those old guys who wrote the Bible didn't know what they're talking about on those issues, you know what? They probably made the rest up as well. And the spiritual baby gets thrown out with the earthly bathwater. We've seen that happen so many times we can't even count. But the Bible is consistent in its treatment of this material. Look at Romans 5:12. Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man. Who's that man? That's Adam. And death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. Now, I don't believe there's any death of animals before Adam sinned, but put that aside. Let's just talk about people. Were people dying before Adam? No, the Bible says Adam was the first one. See, evolution teaches us that death produces people. The Bible says that death is a curse placed upon people after creation. Two very different stories. We get this idea that death is a punishment from the beginning of the Bible. This is Genesis chapter 2, verse 16 and 17. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, you may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. From the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. What happened? Adam reached out and he took the fruit from that tree. And because of that act, God cursed the world. Genesis 3:17, cursed is the ground because of you, and pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. But it's not the dirt that's cursed, it's the universe. Look at Romans chapter 8, multiple references to creation. The creation waits with eager longing. The creation was subjected to futility. The creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption. The whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. The entire universe is weighed down by the weight of Adam's sin, and the entire universe is craving redemption and restoration. Which gives me another opportunity to talk about myself. There's my son, there's my sawmill, this a couple years ago. That's my living room floor. That's 5-inch wide quarter sawn red oak. I took it from a 90-foot tall oak tree that beetles had killed on my neighbor's property. It took me 2 years to make my floor and the molding. That's a lot of fun. It's a great hobby. Keeps you strong, keeps your brain smart. Got to work and work and work and work. The problem is, it's also dangerous. Because to feed a sawmill, you have to run a chainsaw a lot. I call that Rob's right leg's memorial stump. I nearly made a stump out of my right leg. After thousands of hours of chainsawing, cutting down hundreds of trees, I did something dumb. If you're an experienced chainsawer, you know what I did. I cut it this way, and then I cut it that way. The piece was too big to slide off, and there was a piece blocking it. It slid forward maybe 3 inches, pinched the blade, pow! Out of that stump it came. Shin bones are white. Blood is red. If this was 100 years ago, they would have amputated my leg. But thanks to modern medicine, they didn't have to do that. Without antibiotics, I would have gotten gangrene. Shredding wounds like that, that's not good. I don't know why I'm alive right now. This was just 3.5 years ago. A lot of you probably have stories of why you don't know why you're alive right now, too. And the older we get, the more stories you probably accumulate. You know what? If you're a Christian, the reason you're alive is because you're in God's kingdom and God has a purpose for you being alive. Guess what happens when your purpose in God's eyes is fulfilled? You're going to die. And that should be okay because of the promises that are made to us. If you're not a Christian, I suspect that there are people in this room that have been praying for you, that one day you would bow your knee and say, thank you, Lord, you did not have to let me live. Because what a wonderful place it is when we realize that every heartbeat, every breath is a gift from our Creator. The end of the Bible, we hear about our promise. Revelation 21, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning or crying or pain anymore, for the former things are passed away. What are the former things? It's all the junk we got from Adam. And why would I bring Adam up in this context? Because in this chapter and the last chapter in the Bible, Revelation 22, we see a statement, there is no more curse. Oh, that's answering the problem set up in Genesis chapter 3. And then the tree of life reappears. Oh, that's from Genesis chapter 1. Have you ever realized that Revelation is fixing the problem set up in the first book of the Bible? They use very similar themes, and they're like two bookends on a very consistent story. You know what this is? That black squiggly line there, those are all the chapters in the Bible. That rainbow, those are all the cross references amongst all the chapters in the Bible. You can't pull Genesis out of that without destroying the integrity of the rest of Scripture. Because the rest of the Bible quotes Genesis like they quote King David. Like it was history and like it really happened. All God would have had to do is add a phrase of anything that hinted at a long period of time, and we could have driven a truck through that. But those phrases are absent in those first several chapters of Genesis. All the writers of the Bible would have to say was like, okay, back in the stories and poetry of Genesis, and everything would be different, but nobody did that. They quote it like it was real. And so when we read it today, we had better be careful in not adding to it something that's not there. But if Genesis is really history, then the universe then is not millions of years old. And we have a problem because we have to explain the fossil record in just a few thousand years. Can we do that? Well, you remember the Mount St. Helens example, a small disaster called a lot of geology. What if we had an even bigger disaster in Earth's history, a worldwide disaster? Now we're going toward Noah's flood. This is about 1,600 years after that scene in the garden. We have a man named Noah. God says to him, I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them with the earth. God's going to wipe everything out and start from scratch. So he tells Noah to build a large ship. We call it an ark. And in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month on a 17th day, does that read like history? Why else would anyone write it that way if they meant it to be poetry or prophecy? This is written just like history. On that day of Noah's life, all the fountains of the great deep burst forth, the windows of heaven were opened, and rain fell upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, that's nice. Did that really happen? Did it? If it happened, what evidence would you expect to see? That's an even better question. Everywhere I go now, I'm looking for evidence of Noah's flood. And we can see it if we train our brains properly. Let me give you two big ideas. One, think about what rapidly rising muddy water is going to leave behind. And if we're flooding continents, think of the scale, the deposits that we should expect. Second, think about what rapidly decreasing water is going to remove. And as those waters got shallower, maybe they channeled into some and left some really weird things behind. Things like Monument Valley can't be explained with modern processes. Nothing in the world today is creating vertical cliffs. All erosional forces are rounding these things off into nubs. Notice also that all these buttes and mesas have the same height. But if you go northeast, south, and west of here, these rocks go underneath other rocks. There's a mile of missing rocks. Something erased the earth down by a mile, creating a flat plain, and then carved into that plain, leaving behind these very strange features. And there are weird things all around the world that are hard to explain like that. Okay, here's Grand Canyon again. Can you see the pancakes? Can you see the erosion after the pancakes are laid down? Process number one, process number two of Noah's flood, right there in Grand Canyon. But we have to get an understanding of Noah's flood here, a better understanding. This is not a kid's story. This is a horror story. This is the wrath of God. This is God destroying the world. But in the middle of all this judgment, there's a beautiful picture because Noah is a picture of Christ. Through faith in God, Noah came through the waters of death and came out alive on the other side. The New Testament tells us that anyone who puts their faith in Jesus Christ, we usher through the second judgment, this fiery judgment, and come out alive on the other side to inherit eternal life in heaven. How do you survive the wrath of God? Through faith. And Noah showed that to us. But there's a couple other things we need to get. First, the ark is huge. There's plenty of room inside that boat for two of every kind of an animal. That's only a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand pairs of animals, including the extinct ones. There's also enough room left over for all the food and all the water they need for an entire year. But not only that, Noah's ark is perfectly shaped for stability on water. If you made it longer, shorter, taller, or changed the proportions, the ark would rock more. Modern ships built to those proportions are the most stable ships on the oceans. This is tremendous testimony to the scientific reliability and accuracy of the Bible. How did Noah know how to build a ship that we didn't figure out until the 1800s? God told him, and God invented physics. I've shown you a lot of pictures of animals and fossils. There's one last one I want to share with you. This is a jellyfish they found in Utah. They actually found three completely different types of jellyfishes in these rocks in Utah. First question, how do you turn a jellyfish to stone? Woo-hoo, that's a good question. It's not happening today. But these three types of jellyfish, all of them are still alive today. In fact, one of the things I saw a picture of it. I said, oh, that's a box jelly. And in the caption, on the picture, it says, fossilized cubozoa. Sure enough, that's a box jelly. Those are those little things that kill surfers in Australia. Unchanged. The date here, 505 million of years ago. That's a half a billion years. Even to an evolutionist, that's a long time. This is supposedly the middle of the Cambrian era where multicellular life was first evolving. These jellyfish evolved, and then they didn't change for another half a billion years, while one of their cousins turned into bumblebees and panda bears. I have a scientific problem with that, because if evolution can explain radical zero change and radical change at the same time, you can't test evolution. And that's true, you can't, because it's not operational science. It's a philosophy of history. It's historical science. When we do test it empirically, it usually fails. But as an overarching scheme, it claims to explain everything, and that's why it's so powerful. Because from the Big Bang until today, if evolution was true, God is completely unnecessary. The problem with that, though, is at multiple stopping points along the way, we see that evolution actually doesn't work. And there's so much more. That was just a little bit on a couple of topics. There are a lot of other topics for you. Where do you go? Go to creation.com. Pick up a book or a DVD over there to help answer some of your questions. Take a look at our Creation magazine. I think Creation magazine was what God used to keep me in Christianity. And yet, a lot of people haven't read it. And I don't know why. It's fantastic. Even as a PhD scientist, I still learn things in Creation magazine I didn't know. It's like National Geographic, but true. If you would like to get Creation magazine, you have to sign up for it. So I have to explain to you how to get it. This is our sign-up form. It comes out once a quarter, $7.50, four times a year. I was like, one big coffee at Starbucks, if you made it fancy, maybe two. It's not that expensive. We need you to fill this form out, and including all the parts of the form. Scoop through there. There we go. Make sure you sign it. Bring that to the table back there, and they'll take care of you. Now, if you sign up for today, we'll start your subscription. We have the magazines back there. You go home with your first magazine. We'll also give you two free gifts. I'm going to give you a copy of Darwin, The Voyage That Shook the World. This is a movie we made on the life of Charles Darwin. It cost us about $1 million. We went all around the world. We hired a sailing ship. We hired actors. We interviewed PhD evolutionists and PhD creationists. It's a really, really interesting piece. If you want to understand evolution, you have to understand the man. That's what that is. I'll also give you a copy of our Fallout DVD. It's about half an hour long, just interviews with college students. It's really profound. Okay, guys, you can do that now. You will also be signed up for our digital version of our magazine. And this is really neat because you can not only read it on any electronic device you like, we'll let you share it with other people. So we'll send you an email, and the email will be a link. Click on the link, and it'll open up. And you can forward it to people. Now, we say 5 people, but we don't actually count. So if you sent it to 100 people, we wouldn't know. Actually, we think that would be a pretty cool thing. Because maybe it's 100 people who get introduced to information they wouldn't have otherwise had. But I'm going to tell you what. Someone sends me an email, I'm probably not going to click on the link. But if someone sent me an email and said, hey, Rob, I dare you to go to page 13 and start reading. What? I'm going to click on there, and maybe I'll read page 14 or 15 or 16 while I'm there. It's a great way for you to share this with other people, and we hope you will take advantage of this because we want this message to get out.